Episode 32 of the Improvised Music Agenda. Welcome. Who you hear back there is not our guest today, but our guest today is the person responsible for making this recording happen. It is Oliver Weinling of Babel Label, and of course we know him from The Vortex also. So all the music on today's show is stuff that's been released on the Babel Label. And that first track you heard there was Gooch by Dice Factory, which is all available on Bandcamp. I'll link all that. Anyway, so hope you've all been well, and sorry I've not put an episode out for a while. When summer comes, it gets, I just want to chill, basically. And, yeah, I've been working on a bunch of other things as well, so, I've got a recording coming out next year at some point, so I'm kind of getting all my stuff together for finishing off that project, and, yeah, basically playing the bass. So, but yeah, we're back. So, since the last episode I've put out, I've recorded a few more. So there's great ones coming up with Sam Leake, Liam Noble and Laura Jurd. So hopefully they'll be coming out in September. And yeah, so if you're enjoying the podcast, do give a nice review on iTunes or Spotify. I don't know, can you give reviews on Spotify? Anyway, so nice reviews. That helps the visibility of the show. So more listeners, and that probably means a good thing, right? And if you're enjoying it and already given a review, do feel free to go on the Patreon page and donate some money. That'd be absolutely brilliant. Anyway, so the conversation today with Oliver Weinling. If you've been to the Vortex, you're very likely to have met Ollie, who is on the board there, the Vortex, and yeah, so he does a lot of announcements there as well, and yeah, so it's great to chat to Ollie for this conversation, and yeah, keep forgetting how much stuff he's done as well, so it's great to hear his life story, so we talk a bit about that, and of course, he, well, as I previously mentioned, started Babel Label, so yeah, that label's been quite important for me, checking out a bunch of music, even before I met Ollie. Growing up in North Wales, and yeah, so hearing all that music, it was quite tough to pick three bits to play in the podcast. There's the intro and outro music, because there's so many great things on Babel. So, as I mentioned in the podcast, one of the big ones was hearing Last Chance Disco by Acoustic Ladyland, and yeah, unfortunately I couldn't put that on here, because there's so many other great ones. But yeah, do go to their Bandcamp and check it out, because there's loads of great stuff there. And yeah, so the other tunes that will be played is Sheep by Hugh Warren at the end, which is a really special one for me, because that's one of the first tunes I sort of learned. Well, I learned Autumn Leaves, and then I learned to play that, because anyway, I grew up in North Wales and Hugh was there, so, but that's for another time, that story. And the other tune we'll play is Trabans Into the Sunset by Billy Jenkins and the Funhorns, because we mentioned a lot about Billy Jenkins in this podcast, so I thought I'd put that up. Anyway, so less of this intro and more of the conversation. Here's Oliver Weinling. Start off, because this is a thing I didn't know about you until a few weeks ago when you told me. We used to play the clarinet for a while.
I started life as a classical musician. I learnt the piano, I learnt the clarinet, I went to lots of concerts, I did music A-level, and there was then for a short time a discussion about whether I do music or not, but it goes back to something my father said. He said, better off having music as a good hobby sort of having a regular job and having music as a hobby than being a musician and having something else as a hobby. So therefore, I kept the music up as a hobby, and gradually the hobby sort of overpowered, and I gradually, over the years, have met better and better musicians. And so I sort of play my own music in the quiet of my home, except for this one band, which still meets now. We had 40 years ago, which was really got me into jazz when I was at university, called the Oxcentrics, and it's quite... was quite significant in its way in getting me into this end of the music. But we sort of do about one gig every 2 years, so that's when I get out my clarinet. But most of the time, I just think these musicians are so much better than I ever could be or could have been. So it's replacing my aspirations musically is to help it all happen with all you guys.
Yeah, cool. So with that band, so like with those guys... So they're the ones that got you into the kind of...
Well, we started the band at university in Oxford. That's what we call the Oxcentrics. And it was basically Dixieland, trad, played lots of... At Oxford, there were lots of weddings and balls and parties. We even had the band that Tony Blair was doing in Oxford. They did the support actors. He did a rock band in Oxford.
Oh, wow. So,
and they did support, so we were quite well known. What actually happened was that as time went on and I was doing my regular daily work, I was actually an economist for 10 years, and I went along in the about 84, 85 to Morley College in South London. They had a really good Saturday big band. And it was just turn up and play, and I was playing second alto. And at the time, Chris Hunter was first alto. And then I met more and more of these musicians who were developing into Loose Tubes, because a lot lived round the corner. Down the road, there was this place called the Pullens Estate on the Walworth Road, where people like Ashley Slater and whoever were living. And gradually the Oxcentrics became an outlet for them in their early days to come and have gigs. So there I was in doing the horn section, and the rest of the horn section was John Ecott,
wow,
Mark Lockhart, Ashley Slater. And then the time went on, we had all that scene playing with us. And most of Loose Tubes, a lot of Loose Tubes actually did gigs with us at different times. And I said, so it was. I remember Django Bates once doing 92nd, the history of music, into Alexander's ragtime band at a party somewhere in outside London. As one does, everyone needed a gig. But as I also got into it, I've started obviously following all the rest of what they were doing. And that really was my introduction to all this scene, because gradually, we did Oxcentrics gigs. I remember one day we had a gig, and in fact Stuart Hall came along and played bass, but he had a violin with him as well, so he started playing violin too.
Amazing.
And frequently our bass player we then had in the latter days was he was called Dougie Mobbs, which was actually Billy Jenkins.
Right.
So Billy Jenkins was playing bass, and we were using his rehearsal studio where he was working, called Wood Wharf, which he looked after. And so we rehearsed over there. So that's it. It was how gradually I met more and more of the musicians. And then, in fact, it was about 88, 89, I quit my full-time job. You couldn't tell. There'd been a big... sort of recession in the financial world where I was working, and so I can't say did I jump or was I pushed. One can't really say either way. I think it had reached the end of its life for me. We were continuing doing. I was arranging more and more gigs, and actually quite a key development was when I went. Then I got to know a guy in Austria. I was beginning to do more work with these people like Billy, Ian Ballamy. A guy in Austria said, we want to do a day of British bands. And we took over, I remember, Steve Williamson, Tony Remy. I knew nothing really about what went on. Billy Jenkins, whom they worshipped at this place, Wiesen. Mm. And then in another year, they had Earthworks out there. I helped get them Delightful Precipice and all those bands going out there. And so I sort of... it evolved, and I learnt by doing.
Right.
And fortunately, had a very sympathetic range of musicians who were happy to live with my mistakes.
Cool.
Then and actually still live with my mistakes now. And we know, I realize how flexible and creative one is in this scene in solving problems that may arise.
So you're a fan of the music. So when you were doing your job, were you working in finance?
I was working I was an economist working in banks. Right. And I used to go more and more. I would go to Ronnie's till 2 or 3 in the morning, get up at like 6 or 7 and go into work.
Wow.
And then, because that was when, you know, during the week, Ronnie's had the main band did its second set at 1 o'clock.
Oh, wow. So
it was basically a way that during the week, musicians could come and hear the main act.
Yeah.
You know, they always had 2 acts, so I would come along and listen to that. I went along to the original jazz cafe a lot on Newington Green, where it was before it moved to Camden.
Mm.
So that was really where I was learning about the music. And really, I always and still, it's sort of, I keep my ears open, and I would be talking to someone now. And the way I learned a lot of my jazz history is by someone saying, I've been listening to this, I've been listening to that. And I sort of eavesdrop. Yeah. And I go away and I think, oh, well, that's how I'll go and listen to this music. If they listen to it, I trust all the whoever judgment, I will go and listen to it too. And so that's how I'm learning a lot of my the history of the music and the different scenes that have gone on and go on today.
Definitely, because I guess like back then, did it feel like there was like the split personality, like you kind of had Ollie the economist and Ollie the...
Well, I was. I mean, the one was my horror, but then there was one day I realised that my days were numbered when we were arranging a gig, but also I was involved in helping in some transaction of someone, one company was taking over another, and I was getting this call to go to a meeting, and one of the band rang up because I was doing all the organising, as someone said to me, John Ecott once said, and it's true, the worst member of the band is always the manager. Yeah. And so I was the manager, but that was my privilege. I could play with such brilliant musicians because I organised it. And someone rang up and said, I'm busy doing this thing. She said, no, I must know in the next 3 minutes what's going to be happening tonight. And I had to put the other phone call about this big transaction on hold and say, look, I'm sorry, but something major's come up here. And I thought, hang on, if I'm giving priority to arranging the gig, then my days in this financial world are numbered, which they were. But I was continued for many years. I was doing a lot of consulting work and training people and whatever. But I also realize now, when I sit back, there are great similarities between what people are doing in this financial world and what we're doing in the jazz world. It's about taking risk.
Right, yeah.
And actually, I got very into that when I was doing my studies. I did a lot of work. It was to do when I did my master's degree, a couple of brilliant people teaching about how you assessed projects for the World Bank. And the one guy I now realize, when I came across him, he was called Partha Dasgupta, one of the teachers, he's now Sir Partha Dasgupta. It was at LSE, it was fantastic for that stuff. Mm. And you realized it was about how do you assess risks. And, of course, so I was always intrigued by that, but I know that in the world that we're in, you are basically taking risks all the time in the music. And actually, I think that the public, we're all risk voyeurs, and we love watching people take risks.
Yeah, yeah.
And you go, you perform on stage, you take these risks, everyone respects you for taking risks because most other people are unwilling to do it, and then... but no one dies.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's the best thing about music. Like, no one physically gets hurt.
Well, that's why. But you can see why do people enjoy Formula One? And there are people. Billy Jenkins is a massive Formula One go-kart fan. Tom Corley is a big Formula One fan. The worst thing that ever actually happened to Formula One was Ayrton Senna.
Yeah.
Because, why do you watch it? You watch it for exciting overtaking maneuvers in the match. That's why you watch it. That's why you watch Formula. That's why you watch football, because you don't actually quite know what's going to go on.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, we've had these we've done things at various World Cups here called Jazz Ball, which was Billy's idea. We had two teams of musicians accompanying football, and you have to respond to what goes on. And you think, yeah, that's where the similarities. It's, but as I said, it's a great thing, and I think it's a very and that's what I love. And I mean, people, when I hear that you know, it's about taking risk, and we have to trust people. We're not. I think that we as people are not as risk averse as people want to make us out to be. In business, you're told to be, how can I minimize risks? Yeah, you want to minimize risks.
Yeah.
But actually, you want to take risks, and yeah, well, you're taking calculated risks all the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You're doing things, you're taking things to the limit as a musician, which, you know, you're trying to do things that no one else would dare do. I mean, I think it's very exciting when one sees, I mean, bass players, I think, are actually really good at that. When I've seen some bass player as a solo, not just where you learn how to percussive, the way you bow, the way you stick things in a bass.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw actually... in the last few weeks, I saw a gig with three bass players. I was in France, and Bar Phillips playing solo. Phenomenal. Yeah. And they're just wonderful that, you know, so, yes, he starts off by just playing melodies or whatever, but as it goes on, there are all sorts of things one discovers. You see that you realise the bass is a percussive soundboard, so you can hit it properly, you can play around. And musicians, again, these musicians are doing the unexpected. You find things out that actually is not in the rule book. It's not, you know, in the rules of learning an instrument. And I mean, when you learn it, when you're however old you are, any instrument, it's not in the rule. You know, what musicians do and what they've discovered they can do to any instrument. I mean, you know, exactly. When I look at what musicians can do to, yeah, I mean, as I said, I come at it with a clarinet, as a clarinetist, a bit of saxophone, and you know what people ideas they've had, like Evan Parker has developed.
Yeah.
And so I think that really think is that for me continues to be an exciting side of what goes on. And I mean, if people get too safe, quote unquote, I find it. I mean, I just think, no, that's not what we're about. Actually,
no, exactly. That's the worst music is kind of when things that you expect come up, because I saw a tweet the other day. Was it Jeffrey Keyser? I can't remember what the wording exactly, but he kind of gave a formula of like the classic jazz tunes, like the head in and the head out have to sound the same. Bass solo either goes first or last, and kind of everything in between.
Yeah,
but it just made me realise, like, oh yeah, God, that's sort of true. It's kind of worth thinking about.
But it's what the bass solo is. You know, that's a great side, isn't it? Yeah, you have those. Yeah. You have that structure. But what you do to distort the within your structure, within your soloing and whatever. Yeah. And I mean, yeah, it takes a bit of time for the public as a listener to learn and appreciate what goes on. And you can be, because I mean, I think as with anything, the first time you it's like if you leap in the water, you're immersed. You don't quite know. And I think I'm sure that's part of the problem with the... for why audiences get a bit like nonplussed in this scene, whichever bit of jazz in the widest sense it is. But trust yourself. Don't worry. I said trust is elite, and listen, and then you'll get there. And in a way, that's what I have done over the last. It must be nearly 30 years, actually, to my amazement. I thought, you know, always thought, oh, I could give it another year or two, and then I can always go off and do something else. And somehow, I got so deeply immersed that it couldn't go on. The other stuff couldn't go on, and I'm engrossed and involved in this. So, the sort of, is it my hobbies overpowered become the work? I don't know. I can't tell which way it goes.
So when you left the job, so you're saying, so with that festival, was it in Bremen?
It was in Wiesen, festival.
Right, okay. But then you were making connections.
Yeah, well, I'd started connecting. And then actually it sort of led to label. I was doing a lot of work then with Billy, because Billy was so sick of a lot of done. You know, he'd been a successful pop musician for a while. He was the one, he did a band called Burlesque in the 70s, and he'd worked with Ginger Baker and whatever. But yeah, I was doing more work with Ian, and I got involved with the recording of All Men Are Men, which was the second album by Balloon Man.
Yeah.
Which unfortunately is sort of hidden away for a lot of people, but is, I think, a marvellous album.
Oh, yes, incredible, isn't it? Yeah, yeah.
And I went over and I said, well, it's got to be done. So that was my experience. I helped the band get to Bremen. It was a wonderful producer of Radio Bremen called Peter Schulzer, who is now, was one of the founders of Jazz Ahead. But he actually... he loved Ian's playing, and he said to Ian, come on, you must record your band here. And we went out for 3 or 4 days, and I drove, and I learnt one of the things that the manager, or whatever, the organiser, he has the worst time. I drove all the gear out to Bremen over the course of a day.
Wow.
And they flew out, and I arrived exhausted, and they all said, oh, here you are, Ollie, let's all go out now. But I was very proud that we got the stuff over there. They recorded, and I said, and that was the first experience I had watching and listening to the band record there. But one of the two or three things that then led me ultimately to be a record label, because I wasn't a record label. I was just telling, here we are, I've got a great album. It's Ian Ballamy and so on, and no one wanted to release it, or it was a struggle. You'd say,
right,
why not, you know? And in the end, and also when I spoke to the press, I said, hey, you know, there I'm working with Ian Ballamy, I'm working with, a lot with Billy and helping organise bits and a few tours. And I said, you're going to write about them? And they said, no, we need the release.
Right.
You know, because particularly then, less so now, but at that time in the 90s, it's still very geared to the new release schedule. And I mean, you can still see it in some magazines, Jazzwise, which is probably got a lot of that older school mentality, is everything was is still hooked mainly to the album release. Little bits of stuff as people are building their careers and whatever, but ultimately it's, when's the new album, where is it? Now that was very strong, so I thought, well, if we're going to get this stuff written about, we need the recordings. And it wasn't so easy finding the record label. It never was easy. It's still then. So in 1994, I said, okay, I'll do it. And I spoke. There was also, for example, with Billy, there's a man, Wolf Muller, who was head of, well, in the end, he was head of Universal for jazz outside in Europe and outside the USA. He said, Billy Jenkins should be on Verve.
Yeah.
And we went along, particularly these albums, Scratches of Spain. And I remember Richard Cook, you know, from The Wire, Penguin, Guide to Jazz, was running Polygram in the UK, the jazz. And much as he loved the music, and much as he loved Billy, he balked at the possibility of bringing out albums to do with Bromley, Greenwich, and so on. And so I thought, well, if he's not going to do it, and yet one of his boss guy over above him, as it were, coordinator, says Scratches of Spain. And then I then discovered suddenly that I had about 4 or 5 releases. There was Billy with 2 albums of Billy. That very first number one was Entertainment USA.
Okay.
Which was Billy with Martin Speak, Steve Watts, Roy Dodds, and The Straight Man. Really was Martin, because has got such a lovely sound through,
which
it allowed everyone to go bonkers. It was American entertainers, who included Ronald Reagan, real entertainer Ray Charles, Don King, Charles Manson, you know, who led the group that killed
the wife of
Roman Polanski, and that was these were his entertainers in America.
Right.
Billy, and then it was Steve Arguello's Blue Moon in a Function Room, which is a standards album with impeccable playing by Steve Arguellis and Steve Watts and Billy Jenkins and Stuart Hall going mad. They were sort of like a board function band.
Right.
And it's just lovely tracks. They just picked all the tracks on. So I had these albums. So suddenly I'm a record label. I have to think of a name. I have to think of releasing. I've got to find a distributor.
Right.
And you sort of learn. And there's no rule book as to how you are a record label. You probably have no rule book as how you become a podcast.
No, exactly.
You learn how to be, and then you learn how to play bass. You know, you can at least go and learn how to be a bass player.
Yeah, yeah.
You can learn a lot of that thing. There isn't still that. And when I've spoken to other record labels,
yeah,
they're exactly the same. They've been through the same problem. And evolutionary, I got to meet. So that was, as I said, a new Billy, new Steve. Well, I'd worked a bit with Ian, and then it's really, and it's still today. It's getting to know people, getting to know them, hear them, talk to them, trust each other. Of course, you can sort of fall in love. You could fall out of love with someone,
yeah, yeah,
as he thinks. But that's really how Babel has developed over actually now 25 years. Wow. And I'm very proud, actually, of a lot of the releases that Babel has done. I mean, even had two Mercury nominations in its time.
So, but just to kind of think about those first few releases. So, what was the first release? That was Billy Jenkins.
And I had a couple of Billy Jenkins. Then Steve Aguilera's. He has an album, Busy Listening, which was his quintet.
Oh, is that the one with was it Hugh Warren playing accordion?
But also he had the very first one, which had an orange cover. It was more like Steve and Julian's.
Right,
band.
Okay.
They had Kim Burton, who played the band Three Mustafas Three. They had Mick Hutton.
Wow, yeah.
Obviously, Steve. Julian, mainly on alto, a bit of baritone. Oh, okay. And we did two albums, one with a green cap, Busy Listening, and then another one called Circuit a couple of years later. Mm. And that was with Hugh. And then Hugh came in, and Stuart Hall on guitar.
Cool.
And violin. And I remember the first track on the circuit is called Shambles, which is dedicated to Stuart, because that's what Stuart could sort of make the impression of being. So they were the early ones. And then Richard Fairhurst, who via Ian.
Oh, was that Hungry Ants?
The first Hungry Ants one with Ian on it.
Was he like 16 or something?
He was 16.
And then
Tim Giles was in that band. He actually used that album for his GCSE. It was a practical.
Amazing.
And when they went and played Ronnie's, I mean, it was because sort of Balloon Man ended and Ian needed a replacement, and he knew Richard and he knew Tim. So that was how he created a new quartet. Right. And I remember when Tim played at Ronnie's and he needed his father to come along to sort of chaperone him, so he actually wouldn't put his father on the guest list. So Tim's father had to come and pay to get into Ronnie's to look after him. I mean, Tim's got, Tim is as much a case as any of the supportive parents that you have still today, more and more in the scene that we have. Yeah, so Tim, they were some of the others. And then I did Julian Arguelles, three albums with Julian, which I think were really key, actually, to Babel. Home Truths, which was with Steve Swallow.
Oh, wow. I think I know.
Mike Walker, Steve Swallow, Martin France. So it was sort of his successor to Phaedrus, really.
Right, yeah.
And then I did a little duo album. Well, it's sort of himself. And then the first of his octet albums, which was Skull View.
Yeah, yeah.
Which again had a wonderful band with Django just on tenor horn. And Mike Walker, Mark Bassey. And in fact, recorded that back to back with the first album by your fellow North Wales man, Hugh Warren.
Yeah, yeah.
So we had, that was Barrel Organ.
Oh, right, yeah, yeah. So
Barrel Organ. They were actually recorded consecutively. One did 2 days and then the other did 2 days.
What, in the same studio?
In the same studio, yeah, which was called Snake Ranch, which was next to the 606.
Oh,
the
right,
guy,
okay.
Jerry O'Riordan.
Cool.
And they recorded both albums there. So, I mean, that's a hell of a thing to be recording two larger groups. So, you see, I got to know Hugh actually a lot through Billy Jenkins. Billy worked a lot with Hugh. He did this thing with the Fun Horns, German horn section. And it was sort of a mixture of those things that so that's where I said I got to know and did and worked a lot with Hugh, and I said he did stuff with Billy, and then did Hugh's own things and with Peter Herbert and the solo Infinite Riches in a Little Room, his Welsh album, isn't it?
Oh, Dua Wir,
with Llewyn Stephen, which is vocal. It's sort of, I think it's a bit of a precursor of the stuff Hugh has done with Quercus.
Yeah,
in
I
some
guess
ways.
So, yeah, so that kind
the
of
the
like
line up that's with Mark Lockhart, and whenever I speak, you know, Mark is himself is a big fan of those. So I'm very, when the musicians come back and they say how lovely it was to do those albums, makes me a bit sad. At least they are available. At least, you know, you could go out, you can still buy a lot of them. We still have a warehouse full of albums. All right. Down there. But also, I mean, it is actually one of the nice things nowadays, although one earns a pittance, but jazz has always earned a pittance, that there are the Spotify's or the Bandcamp the SoundCloud, that this music is available. And I must say, availability of the music is very important, the continuity of the music. So I regard that as crucial, and the fact that the catalogue is pretty well all there and available, and one can really see, and it's a nice history of this music over the course of 25 years. I said, and I got caught, I got hooked into Fire Collective, so I worked with them, did Polar Bear, a couple of albums of Seb, Acoustic Ladyland, Ingrid Laubrock, Tom Arthur's.
Oh, wow.
That was the Fire Collective.
Cool.
In fact, I remember there was a Tom did his band Centripede, which was with Ingrid. Max the Wardener.
Oh, okay.
Was a bass player, more of a composer. I've been in touch with him recently over a couple of things. So that was Tom's first album. Of course, Tom is now in. And then, so it sort of, you look at it and things sort of went in a very, very evolutionary. I mean, I picked up people and I said, but getting to know people now where we're sitting here in the Vortex is a sort of community hub. And so that's where I get to know the musicians.
Totally. But thinking with Babel label.
Yes.
We have
the Babel, we have the Babel label stable.
All right, cool.
The fabled. We got it's a really Babel. Great word. I like the word Babel because of the Tower of Babel and all the languages. So actually, and the Tower of Babel. And so I did the newsletter, which I think I might, if I looked around, I could find.
Right.
But when you could still do physical newsletters, I called it View from the Tower.
But with those albums though, because I know in my kind of formative years, I guess, a lot of those albums had an impression on me, so.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing. It's wonderful when I hear back.
Yeah, but the one in particular, though, is Acoustic Ladyland.
The first one or the second one?
The last chance disco. So, because I was like really into like the whole rock thing at that point.
I mean, it was a very, yes. And I mean, it was quite a shock on the jazz world when that was beginning to come back into that sort of rockier side, which obviously Peter's continued with Melt Yourself Down and so on.
Yeah.
And I did, because the first album we did, though, which is a very nice album, was Camouflage,
which was
a Hendrix sort of, officially it's not Hendrix covers because the estate would say you can't use the names and the...
Right. So they're kind of based on...
But it was based Hendrix on that, teams. And that's why it kept the name Acoustic Ladyland, because of course that was Electric Ladyland. Going to Acoustic Ladyland, and then we kept that name, and then Last Chance Disco. But that was a sort of an incredible year, because I had at that time all close together. There was also Polar Bear.
Oh, okay, so
held on the tips of fingers almost at exactly the same time.
Oh, well, and they
and Acoustic, and they were the same, and it was very intriguing because Acoustic Ladyland on the one hand was album of the year in Jazzwise that year and was all over the thing. The place, but actually sort of came up from behind. They were on later with Jules.
I think that's the point where kind of the switch went on for me. Just seeing them on Jules Holland.
Well, absolutely.
Just, Pete just like screaming on the saxophone and rocking out
but
and improvising. But
Polar Bear was not a wholly dissimilar band.
No.
Polar Bear actually that year got a Mercury nomination.
And
it was I had a little thing I had to go over to see the Mercury, because it's a commercial prize, basically. But sympathetic guys. So I went over there and I had a special, I just had to sign a confidentiality agreement, because it was like 4 days before the announcement. And they'd got to the last 18 albums, I had to pick 12. Right. And both Acoustic Ladyland and Polar Bear were in this last. And he said, well, look, we can't have two albums from a tiny label, because, you know, you can't afford, we got to get the big labels in to pay the press. And, you know, I mean, they've had the Spice Girls actually. They got Mercury nomination one year. Yeah, they had. So anyway, so they said, well, we can only have one or the other. Can you make a double album out of it? I said, of course not. You know, they tried to say, is there a way around? But it's intriguing that the Mercury Prize picked actually held on the tips of fingers. Which I said, not wholly dissimilar band. There's Pete.
Yeah, I guess.
Of course, there's Mark Lockhart
doing
it as the other Saxon, sort of, a sort of father figure, giving stability.
Yeah, yeah.
And then was just beginning with Leafcutter John and Tom Herbert, who did both, and Seb, who they both did Acoustic Ladyland. They did Acoustic Ladyland with Pete, three of the members of the band.
Yeah.
Sort of we're going out like, well, same, almost the same. So it was a bit, but yeah, that was a year of. And of course, Partisans, which I was also, I think that was Sourpuss.
Oh, right, yeah,
which is very nice, quite a natural sound, which they've almost gone back to more of, because they went through ones which got a bit more, well, they got more complexity, added in a few more musicians.
Yeah.
Sourpuss was their second album, was sort of, their pure Partisans.
Yeah,
and I mean it's great that they continue today. It's very rare that a band is really still around that has lasted that long in this field.
Yeah, totally. Because they did some gigs recently.
They did, absolutely, and they're back at the Vortex in September because their last album was a live recording from the Vortex.
Oh, cool.
So you know, and so that's why they're very keen to be back and. And we have Phil, and then of course I've done a lot of work with Christine Tobin, who overlaps into Hugh. I mean, there was quite a sort of, you look at them and you see the people, what they do. And I mean, Christine, who I remember just going to, she was always taking the money at gigs that all these musicians were doing. She was organising a bit, and then she comes up to me and she has her first album, Alleluia. With Hugh Warren. And actually one of the best solos on Babel, Hugh Warren's solo on The Priest by Joni Mitchell.
Okay,
one of the
cool.
there are three or four moments in Babel. It's like there is actually an Ian Ballamy solo on a Billy Jenkins album called The True Love Collection, and he's doing a solo on Everybody's Talking. And again, Ian's solo is magnificent. They like little,
yeah,
but
yeah.
Anyway, yeah, so Christine came along. And because then she's obviously been with Phil now for many years.
Yeah.
Well, she's we don't really see her now because she's in New York.
Yeah.
Living there, but yeah, it was a very, very proud of those albums, and not to forget the sort of hidden man of Loose Tubes, because that still was my main connection, which was Steve Buckley.
Oh right, yeah, because he's back in London now.
He's back playing again, thank God. But everybody, he was. Almost a bit of the forgotten man. He was the quiet man of Loose Tubes. They well revered, and obviously had his very long-term collaboration with Chris Batchelor, particularly, which is two albums on Babel Life as we know it, which is basically the two of them, a lot of overdubbing, and it was the original. It was when looping could really get going, and you could do those tracks in the beginning of Pro Tools and whatever. And then with Paul Clarvis and Mark Sanders.
Wow.
And then the second one was Big Air, which was Myra Melford, Jim Black,
yeah.
And Oren.
Yeah, no, I've got that record. It's amazing, that. Because where did they record that? Was that in London they recorded that?
Yes, yeah. The original, I remember, plan had been to record it at BBC with the BBC in Leeds, but the piano was out of tune. It was a live recording. For Jazz on 3, and they won a BBC Jazz Award for New Composition. These awards were around.
Yeah,
we have very few of them now, but it was nice. So they won that, and then in the end they recorded it at Eastcote Studios.
Right, cool.
Philip Baganall, and they went there, and they've got Peter Beckman, you know, who's masters a lot of albums.
Oh yeah,
still,
that's right.
Works
yeah.
a lot with Alex Bonney, and he's. He's mastering. See him, and they were Steve Buckley, Chris Batchelor, and Peter Beckman were all at college together in Leeds.
Oh, okay.
Although, as I've learned, and if you check it out, Chris and Steve were playing together when they were 15.
Oh right, yeah, because they're from
Southeast London,
and
with Django, they were all playing down in Southeast London.
Oh yeah,
they did a club in Rotherhithe. I discover when I talk to them more, and I hear the history is way, way before they got going in Loose Tubes.
Yeah, yeah.
So they've been doing they've been playing together. Chris and Steve have been playing together for 40 years.
That's amazing.
More than 40 years, I mean, one can wax lyrical about that, but it's lovely that. Having said that, we go back to Babel. I've been, we'll probably talk a little bit about
the vortex effect in a bit, which has distracted me. But I'm still, you know, I'm now pushing a few things again. I've had a few albums which I'm afraid didn't really get as much awareness of as they should have done. But right. I'm getting back, going with them more again. And I've got, you know, the circle of musicians that I'm now working with. Continue to see some of the similarities, a few of the older musicians, but I realize I can sort of look at a few of the trends within Babel that are also there. I think I'm obsessed by pianists, actually.
Right, okay. So who are the big ones? Because I guess like Bruno Heinen.
Well, Bruno Heinen, I'm doing the stuff with Bruno now. I've done now half a dozen albums with him, but I said Hugh. I feel that, you know, we look at where someone in this scene, where Django is.
Yeah.
I mean, the influence that goes back bit older, but obviously you're not around, who's actually on one baby, John Taylor. He's on a Phil Robson album, Impish.
Oh, okay. Brilliant.
Which was Phil did a trio album with Dave Whitford and Asaf Sirkis, and JT came in and did a few tracks. He looked like the photograph I got. He looks like a schoolboy. Lovely attitude that John had. But you look at that lineage here, and I think you look at a lineage through music. If you look at the importance of a monk or so on, but over here, the Django, I think Hugh Warren, Julie Sassoon, pianist who's now living in Berlin,
right? Yeah,
and I said now Bruno is one of those that I sort of get attracted, work with Liam, and I know actually tonight at the Vortex Alciona is playing, and I think you know, I've actually got an album which, again, it was one that I brought out, didn't see as much as it should, which was Elliot Galvin, a duo, Elliot Galvin and Mark Sanders.
Yeah.
So, you know, I said, pianists for me, I think others are also are very innovative, but I said, somehow I come back to, I love pianists. I think I said, if I look at the trends over the last few years, I said the imagination that in this music that comes from them sometimes don't quite get the recognition that they deserve or comes back later.
Yeah.
But it has, there's something in there in the piano, which I said, and the pianists.
Yeah.
And if they don't have it, then I think, well, you know, but here, thank God, we've had people like JT, the influence which has followed on through the generation, like Django and Hugh, and it keeps going down. And I'm very happy, and I think, you know, Bruno has got that lovely attitude and a very broad-minded in what he's doing. And I mean, now I've done another nice trio with him, but you know, but it just gets on with it, doesn't it? I mean,
definitely, he's done, and he sounds incredible as well, Bruno. Because I heard him some session the other week, but just like the things he's doing at the moment, you know, with was it because he's been studying PhD?
He did. He just finished his PhD.
Counterpoint in jazz?
Counterpoint with special reference to Fred Hirsch.
That's right, yeah.
And he's done a solo piano album, which was actually called Mr. Vertigo, which he submitted as part of his PhD.
Oh, amazing.
But I remember I was first intrigued, and there was a connection actually to Julian Siegel. Yeah. I heard him once do his Stockhausen album.
And then
along came one day, Julian said, "Oh, I've got this wonderful pianist, Bruno Heinen, I've been working with. I think about releasing his album," which was Twinkle Twinkle with Andrea DiBiase and John Scott. And I thought, so it's sort of, you hear about something and then it strikes a note. But that, in a way, I mean, maybe we should do a little bit about even my Vortex side, or else we could go on
about
Babel.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
But I was thinking that's why I got sucked in and have been sucked into to the Vortex a lot, and the music one hears here, and you know, and knowing what goes on. I mean, that was and keeping it going, which is another story in itself. You know, that's where I meet people like yourselves. And it's a lovely community of the music that we're in.
It feels like it's the center of the universe for like all the stuff that
Yeah, it gets a little bit. It's there. It doesn't go away. We've got to. It is always. I mean, I took the baton really from David Mossman.
Yeah,
who started it over 30 years ago, and obviously, I mean, he sadly died at the end of last year. But the attitude that he had which was also trusting musicians. I mean, he came in, he knew nothing about music.
Right.
He came in, he knew about Neil Diamond was his big
thing.
But he started a jazz club and didn't know about jazz. But also loved risk. He was a rock climber, very serious rock climber. And I thought, it's this risk loving and that's why I come back to that subject a lot. And I sort of, when we, the Vortex had to move from where it was in Stoke Newington, and that's when we sort of restructured it to how we are today. And I became what I would say is the most active director. We have a board, yeah, but sympathetic, and with the volunteers and so on. But this idea of needing a hub where people can go for it and are trusted. Unfortunately, there are more and more musicians that want that. But being open, because the outlets of venues are getting fewer and further between. Mm. I'm quite
definitely.
It's one of the things that I'm very concerned about. And we actually started an EU project before Brexit.
Right.
But we had the first meeting. It's called Jazz Connective.
Oh, great!
And it's a series of conferences and gigs. With about seven sort of venues, really, not really festivals. Festivals may overlap, but seven venues across Europe: Dublin, London, Birmingham. We had our first meeting last week in Slovenia, in Ljubljana. But you realise that the venues are vital. And when I looked at the scene and the number of musicians who actually, there were musicians from all around the countries, and a high percentage of the particular groups playing have played at the Vortex,
yeah,
as well, and happy to have done it. And it's always though the hard one is, when can we get them back again, and how do we make enough money to keep going?
No, exactly.
And, because, you know, but that's been always an ongoing problem of this music. It's,
yeah,
not really
true.
You know, it's, and all the story, I mean, when you hear those stories by Ronnie Scott, you know, how do you make a million out of jazz start with two? He tells those stories.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
And I follow those stories a lot, another side of what I do.
Yeah.
Jazz clubs have always struggled. And I think that they've also, maybe their reputation amongst the funders is not high. I think the Arts Council would probably balk,
yeah,
when they hear the word jazz club.
Right.
Ooh,
yeah,
dear, all the connotations of jazz, you know, the jazz cigarettes,
right, yeah,
the,
yeah,
jazz mags,
yeah,
and so on and so forth, which give us our sort of alternativeness, which we try and, well, we I think that they've been more sympathetic, perhaps, but the funders, at the end of the day, at least we can keep going. We know how to keep going. We're not so reliant on an Arts Council that if they pulled the money out tomorrow, we wouldn't survive. We just have to, we just live. We adapt to the means.
Yeah, exactly.
And,
yeah,
and with you all. So, you know, there's that's that. Good. So, but I said, it's a great thing that keeps it going, and it's a wonderful thing to get to know and meet musicians. And I mean, to be able to have had a lot of conversations with these geniuses like Kenny Wheeler, where it was for him his preferred venue in London.
Yeah.
Norma, that generation of musicians as a start, John Taylor and so on, where the Vortex was always open to them to just say, you want a place to play, of course you can come and play there. And otherwise, I mean, you know, the struggle today, and it was always that to get your, you know, get a gig at the other venues in London, Ronnie's or Pizza Express or whatever. You,
yeah,
know, you will have some, but, you know, it's the economics of this jazz world, which we have to constantly work out how to get around that problem.
Totally, yeah, yeah. But so when did you first get involved with the Vortex?
Well, I was going to the Vortex with the musicians, and that was where he, if you look at the things, there were these wonderful seasons that Billy actually did, and I was very involved with Billy at the time through the 90s. And he did these months of, he did a fashion show.
Oh, okay.
He did a sort of religious songs of praise. He did some of these football. He did very strange sort of monthly seasons. He did these big fights, which are two musicians in a boxing ring.
Oh, right.
But creating music. It's,
yeah,
sort of,
yeah,
a musical boxing ring.
Sure, yeah.
And I used to referee those. So that was what got me more involved and overlapping in attitude, and got to know David Mossman, who started the Vortex, very well. And then it got to a stage he thought about either leaving or he had was an offer to go to a venue called Ocean, which was a ill-fated attempt to build a concert hall in Hackney, which is now the Picture House there.
Okay.
But it was a lot of money that they spent, and he nearly went in there. And I remember when we all went round, people like Julian Siegel, myself, Eddie Parker, Penny Rambo, we all said, don't move. And then we started saying, where can we find an alternative? We tried to buy the building where the Vortex was, but a property developer slipped in and bought it.
There a Stuart Lee routine about that, isn't there?
There is a Stuart Lee routine, absolutely. About and because he was and still is living up there.
Right.
And then by chance, someone turned up to a gig who's Adam Hart, his brother Charlie Hart, who played a lot with Billy, goes back to Ronnie Lane and worked a lot with Billy Jenkins, a lot of world music. He was doing a gig at the Vortex, which was actually a Babel album launch. And we said, we're looking for a new... I was introducing that night. I said, we're looking for a venue. Does anyone have one? And this guy, Adam Hart, said, yeah, this is a cooperative property company, Hackney Cooperative. I said, yeah, I'm about to build in Dalston.
Wow.
And we said, in 2004, we said, well, do we really want to be in Dalston? Well, I suppose if we have no alternative, we're here. So that was really how I got more involved, and we set up a not-for-profit business. We have, I said, volunteers. And in fact, the official name of this company is New Vortex Jazz Club Limited. So although it's the Vortex still.
Yeah, yeah.
And we learned a lot from David Mossman. We tried to keep that proper continuity to the older generation that he used to have in regularly, be it Stan Tracy, Carol Grimes, and so on. But then evolving it to be... in the way that we are, and I sort of gradually took on more and more of the role of the front man, which I think a jazz club needs a front man.
Totally, yeah.
And I think you need to be welcomed, you need to know where you're coming to. It's like when you go to play anywhere.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's the nice thing of the small clubs, which are once a week, and the passion that the clubs have. But I mean, I think, you know, where you have places, and it is sad when, you know, it's like if you went to the South Bank and played there. Who do you meet? You don't meet the people who booked you or who let you into the place. It's
totally.
Some, you know, people, you walk in there and it's someone who's like, yes, there's a manager for the night, we're all right. But it's the impersonal, the personal side. This music, if we're going to have anything, it's about a personal side. It's about you and me having a chat.
And
I think, you know, these podcasts and so on are a perfect outlet for getting to know what goes on.
Totally,
the formality too. That really is how I got involved at the Vortex and have continued to be. And looking around, and I've been more outward looking into looking at the European side, particularly developing some of the links, which we all do organically, but working much more, always believe in a bottom-up approach, working much more organically with musicians, trusting... Where you want to work, you know, you will come in and say, I want to work with X, Y, or Z.
Yeah.
And, you know, musicians whom you have met, like Devin or someone like that. Yeah. Why do we have Devin Gray here and then we have his band? Because you say, hey, I've got this guy I know well, rather than it's, oh, Hugh, I mean, you have those as well, you know.
Yeah.
When you work with so-and-so, may or may not work, but we're doing still those sorts of projects, which are, I mean, that comes from also our connections with collectives. We seem to have gone a bit quiet. Collectives, are there any collectives around at the moment?
Not so much. I haven't noticed any as much. Because, I mean, last time maybe there was like Chaos Collective for a moment.
Yeah.
You know, with that Laura, Elliot, Corey, and those guys.
Yeah.
But then, I think that's gone a bit quiet, isn't it? But I'm wondering whether that would be a good thing for the general scene.
Well, I think people...
Happens anyway, doesn't it? Because you get like different pools of people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, tonight's gig is a sort of case in point. We've got Robin Finker back, where it's Loop. Was one of the reasons we got our first links to Paris was Loop and the Coax Collective.
Right.
Sylvain Darifoux, Julien Despre, and so on. And today's gig is sort of hooked up, and this Bedmakers, which is sort of based on French musicians. Primarily, although Dave Kane's doing it, playing English folk songs.
Right, cool.
Which comes from follows on from a band that Robin did before called Wahe with Paul Rogers, which I helped release.
Oh, wow.
Where they were doing Mingus.
Amazing.
We should check that one out. Wahe.
Yeah,
great,
cool.
Great album. Paul Rogers, though, disappears within himself quite a lot, sad to say, but is a few weeks ago, a genius, of course.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Seven-string bass.
Seen him play a few times. Actually, I think I remember seeing him playing with Dave Kane. You know, there's like Adventures in Sounds thing. I think they were possibly playing a duo.
Yes.
But that was really cool. Well, to see Paul,
we've seen him here. We did. He did his 60th birthday here. We're talking about that when I saw him a few weeks ago. Obviously, he was a really part of Magician with Tippett, Paul Dunmall.
Yeah.
But he's living in Le Mans in France, and because he's got a daughter there, a young daughter who must be about 9 or 10 years old, he wants to be near her. Cool. So he's really not, we don't see him enough back here.
Yeah,
but
she
was talking to him about the history of, he was going back when he was playing in the 70s with people like, actually with people like Django, and also then Rutherford and the improv scene. So, you know, it is a very, it's nice to do that. But I said the venues, we don't have. But the Vortex has been, is, and hopefully will continue to be, important side, and the continuity of venues, continuity of festivals is vital. I think I had this discussion with a few people recently. A record label can end.
Right, yeah.
As long as there's a catalogue and it's available.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the sad part is the music that is not available, that has been released because it's got stuck in some vault in some major label.
Yeah.
Somewhere, which like All Men Are Men, which was his label, which was B&W. These albums, there was a label EG which brought out the second Human Chain album, Cashing In, the first Balloon Man album, which is difficult to get hold of, you know. And I think it's stuck somewhere. It was EMI, so it's probably stuck somewhere in Universal. And you try and prize it out. It's not easy.
No.
So having music available is key on a label.
Mm.
You know, you look at ECM and those sorts of labels, and as long as the good albums are available, but they can end.
Yeah.
You know, in a way, it's like you see Blue Note today. Should it have stopped in 1966 when they had their big successes? Or it continue today? Well, perhaps no, it continues, but in the way it continues. But I think for festivals, for venues, the history, the continuity, I mean, I think it's a great thing that you know, that Ronnie's has got to 60. I mean, the Vortex is a baby compared to other venues. We're only 30 years old in London.
Yeah.
60 years of Ronnie's, over 40 years of 606, Pizza Express.
Yeah.
And they move, like, you know, Ronnie's moved, Pizza Express has moved. Not Pizza, 606 moved.
Right, okay.
And Vortex moved. So that's allowed, as long as you keep a certain attitude going. And I actually do, it's one of my hobbies, it's called Lost London Jazz Venues.
Oh, right, okay.
And I found 280 that no longer exist.
Wow.
Nearly 300.
That's mad. So that's like dedicated venues? Or
it's
like
Google,
nights promoted by people? Or?
Yeah, a mixture.
Right.
But I have a Google map called Lost London Jazz Venues. And a lot of them were in Soho. About 30% were in Soho.
Wow.
But that's gradually, I'm finding more and more, which occurred
before
the Second World War. I always find a few people tell me stories. And I said, but I was thinking the Vortex, because these venues have moved, and the struggle of venues to survive.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, London is really struggling for grassroots venues.
Yeah.
And 40% have gone.
Oh, man.
So, you know, in rock, pop, jazz. But jazz, I think there are under 100 left, about 8 of those, 7 are jazz ones who've really lasted. Bull's Head.
Yeah.
How long has that been going? It's been going forever.
Yeah.
Like in bars. 608. They're all, and that goes back, I mean, Bull's Head, I think, goes back to the 50s.
Wow. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And Ronnie's sort of goes back to, you know, instead of 60 years.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, jazz, we know how to duck and dive.
Totally. Yeah.
And I think that's very important, and that's in the end what makes it. I mean, even if the music thing, one isn't earning, you know, now we have to say, okay, you know, we had for a while, you might have earned a bit more money when albums were being sold or when CDs were being sold, but even then we get thrown. We work out how we can get ourselves out from the back of the warehouse of all the music, the millions of tracks that are around there.
Yeah.
We work out how to survive with it. I mean, you know, as Zappa said, jazz doesn't die, it just smells funny. It's, the rock world, they keep coming back and they keep finding jazz again. And you know, we're in another little buzz. It's a particular side of the scene in London, obviously, which has been picked up bit through Giles Peterson and on the jazz refresh scene, but it's there. And suddenly jazz is like, oh wow, gosh, we thought we'd killed you off.
When it
doesn't go away. They probably thought they'd killed off free improv. But free improv
is booming
relatively. I mean, definitely. Years when Loose Tubes were going, the free improv scene had a period when it was just in the backs of pubs.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And it wasn't. It was much more composed. The music was very much more composed. I mean, I have a lot of thinking about that. And actually, this Jazz Connective really made me think about. I think jazz has been an art music now for the last 30 years, which is why we're on the BBC on Radio 3, why we've been playing much more in concert halls, why you can study it at conservatoires. And but we've got to watch out. But thank God, we must let what the venues do at least is they work out how we can, if that money from the Arts Council fully dried up, if the BBC vanished... BBC vanished, your people like you are taking over on the podcast.
The DIY.
If the arts in the DIY, if the Arts Council grants vanished, you'd work out a way of keeping going.
Totally, yeah.
And that, I think, is very... And we mustn't lose sight of that, much as we love the serious element, you know, and, as well. But the vibe, we mustn't lose, because that gives this music... And the attitude and the approach of who everyone is, and audience, a resilience. And we mustn't get stuck in a certain sort of, you know, which I mean, unfortunately, was maybe a little bit of the way that Lincoln Center sort of made it into a structure and a lineage. Lineage of jazz is vital, but that part of the lineage of jazz is to do with it working out how to keep going.
Exactly, yeah. Well, cool. I think that's a good note to end on. But
okay, yeah,
thanks
great.
So much for doing this, Ollie.
That's all right. My pleasure. You can hear I have too many ideas at times, but at least I implement some of them. That's a good deal. And that's why it's wonderful to know all the people like yourself.
Cool, thanks.
Keep it going.
There we go, Oliver Windling there. And yeah, hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. And to play us out, here is Sheep by Hugh Warren. See you next time. Bye.